sizes. With many of these diplomatic imperatives seemingly resistant to traditional foreign policy prescriptions, some have suggested that it is time for the United States to define a new grand strategy in foreign policy, one designed to move the country away from political polarization and piecemeal response and towards greater policy consensus on how to address the major foreign policy challenges of our time. But there is considerable disagreement on how to achieve these goals. Today on The Exchange, a grand strategy for American foreign policy. Let's hear from you. What do you think are the most pressing foreign policy challenges facing the U.S.? What should be the central features of a unified American foreign policy? Are there specific issues or regions of the world that you would like to see get more attention from the U.S. and its policymakers? What role, if any, should domestic politics play in how our foreign policy is defined? Call in. The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. I have two guests with me for the hour today. Joining me in studio is Bill Martell. Bill is an associate professor of international security studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. And Bill is author of Victory in War, Foundations of Modern Strategy. Bill, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks, Dean. It's good to see you.
Also joining me on the phone from Jerusalem is Charles Kupchan. Charles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and former director of the National Security Council. He's also a professor of international affairs at Walsh School at Georgetown University. His new book is No One's World, The West, The Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. Charles, it's good to have you with us all the way from Israel.
Happy to be with you.
Gentlemen, I'd like to start by giving our listeners a brief overview of what each of you mean by the idea of grand strategy in foreign policy, and also initial sense of what you see as the key building blocks of a unified foreign policy. But let's keep it big picture for the moment, sort of a thumbnail sketch, if you will. Bill, let's start with you. What's the big picture here?
Sure. Grand strategy. So for everyone who's thinking this is really wonk stuff, it's not. What grand strategy is a statement, and it can be very simple, very, very involved, which says, in essence, what are the principles, what are the ideas that govern American foreign policy? Now, a couple of points about that. One, that doesn't only mean foreign policy stuff. It means as much the domestic foundations of American power as it means anything else. It's second, I always categorize grand strategy as that set of concepts that loosely say, what is it you do in the morning when you wake up in foreign policy? For 40 years, 50 years, we can sort of debate when the clock ended. But from the late 40s until the early 90s, we had a very clear vision of what foreign policy is about, which was contain the threat posed by the former Soviet Union. It had political components, military, economic, and technological alliances on a global scale. When the Soviet Union came apart formally at the end of 1991, when essentially the Union was dissolved and it became Russia with a series of successor states, American foreign policy coasted along for a decade and change, probably until 9/11, with a sense that while we no longer had a threat to contain, it provided a certain orderliness to American foreign policy. I argue that's gone, and what I think we're seeing in American foreign policy, both in terms of this sort of waves of intervention and opposition to intervention, we have this chaotic quality to American foreign policy, which says, we as American people really don't know what it is we should be doing in foreign policy on a day-to-day basis.
And in fact, you use this concept of disorder in some of your writings, that the organizing feature of our unified policy now has to be dealing with the sort of disorderly nature of the foreign policy environment.
As the expression, Dean, goes, yea, verily. And I can't think, for example, I was thinking as Dean was doing the introduction, I was thinking that to be discussing grand strategy from Israel and from the United States, from Concord, New Hampshire, is a pretty powerful emblem or symbol of this world that we have to deal with. And the world, for reasons we can talk about, shows great signs of just increasing disorderliness on a variety of fronts.
Absolutely. Charles, your take on the idea of a grand strategy and some of the building blocks behind it.
I would agree with what Bill just said and maybe give it a slightly different spin in the sense of talking about the process, intellectual and political, of keeping objectives and resources in balance, of figuring out at the big picture level what it is that a country wants to do in the world, and then looking at home and saying, what are the resources that we have available to achieve those objectives? What's our military strength? What's our economic strength? Are we politically together? Do we have a consensus? Are we divided? And then going about and figuring out a means-end chain to put the resources to good use to achieve the objectives. And it involves setting priorities. It involves, in some ways, I think, an architectural kind of intellectual enterprise where you look out at the world and you say, what are the main threats? What are the opportunities? How are we going to come up with a grand strategy, a means and chain to take advantage of those opportunities and meet those threats? And during the Cold War, it was relatively simple because there was a threat that concentrated the mind, and then we had a debate about how to meet that threat, where to put the troops, how much to spend on defense. That concentration of the mind created a bipartisan consensus that lasted for the better part of the Cold War. And now we're in a world in which we're not sure what our priorities are. We're not sure about the durability of American power. Domestic consensus has given way to polarization. And so both at the external level, what do we want to do in the world, and the internal level, the resources that we have available, the political solvency of the nation, all of this is now under debate and up for grabs. And that's, I think, probably good news for people like Bill and I who make a living talking about grand strategy.
Yeah, in listening to you, it sounds like the rub is in figuring out how to deploy resources. You know, I think at some level you can have objective measures of what our resources are, but it's a fundamentally political question of how you use those resources. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, you would go around the world with a map and you would say, this is what we need to do in the Middle East. This is what we need to do in the Strait of Hormuz to keep the flow of oil going. This is what we need to do in East Asia. And then you add it up and you say to the Pentagon and to domestic defense industry, here's the list of objectives. How are you going to meet those objectives? But in the end of the day, it's much more political than that, and it's much more chaotic than that. We know that the Pentagon just, you know, is a very political and difficult bureaucratic process. So the reality of making grand strategy is much more ugly and much more difficult than it is in theory.
Bill, how do you make decisions about those resources?
To me, there are two poles, if you will, that we have to deal with. One is the resource side that Charles is talking about, and I'm in heated agreement. I mean, that's absolutely right, and I think it's an incontestable set of arguments. The second part to me is this issue that says what it is we're trying to do. Now, democracies, I'm thinking of the famous Churchill quote, democracy is the worst form of government with the exception of all the rest. Democracies have very messy qualities to them. One of their messy qualities is they tend to be better at responding to a threat than organizing themselves in the absence of a threat. So what's missing now, and this is, I think there's a pretty broad consensus in this, there's no clear sense of what it is that really threatens us. We have terrorism, we have proliferation, we have all kinds of other forces, rising states, but there is no thumbnail sketch that says, aha, this is what we're going to do. And that, unlike what happened in the 1940s after the Second World War, there was a crystallizing moment. It was the Civil War in Greece, it was the ascent of growing Soviet pressure in Europe and around the world that caused this coalescing, this crystallization in American society on, aha, this is what we need to deal with. This is how we need to organize ourselves. I'm very Lincoln-esque in this regard, and Lincoln said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing him, there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you have public support behind you, and without public support you can't accomplish anything. And I think step one for me has always been articulate what this world looks like in the messy sense that it exists, and formulate from there something that says the American people, now I get it as to why we should be involved in global affairs. Once that exists, the issue of resources is front and center, and that as Charles pointed out, we were really good at this in terms of organizing what our strategy was and what kinds of resources we needed to basically hem in or contain, as the expression was, Moscow. And we were very good at this. And in fact, I'll give you an example later of how good we were at that.
So the issue, in addition to the resource allocation political question, is the kind of the reactive nature of foreign policy currently. It's hard to have a unifying theory when you're just kind of reacting to situations as they occur.
And Charles made this point very well in something that he wrote, I'm sure he'll jump in here, is that if you're reactive, if you don't have a grand strategy, then you tend to overreact, underreact, without getting to all the debates of Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. But there's this, you know, the sine wave, this wave of lots of activity, no activity, lots of activity. And I think that is very weakening to democracies. I'd also point out democracies are much better, I hate to say this, at responding to threats than organizing themselves to deal with threats.
Charles, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, number one, I'm kind of a great power guy in the sense that if you look back at history, history has been shaped more by the Russias, Germanys, Japans, and Americas of the world than by the Botswanas and Belizes of the world. And so when you talk about grand strategy, you're really saying, who are the players that have power? What's the relationship among those nodes of power? And what can we do to kind of deal with competition? That, you know, that's a question now that everyone debates in the sense that a lot of people say, well, 9/11 changes that. After 9/11, history is going to be made by weak, failed, or failing states and no longer by great powers. We've entered a period of great power peace, whether nuclear weapons, whether it's democracy, whether it's commerce. And so now we got to focus on the rest of the world. That's where the danger is. I'm not convinced. I mean, no question that 9/11 is something that caused a huge turnaround in our thinking about the world. But in some ways, it caused too huge a turnaround.
We have to take a quick break here. We'll be back shortly, and we'll continue talking about American foreign policy and grand strategy. That plus your call. So please stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More of our grand strategy for American policy on the exchange on NHPR, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, efforts to stop violence against women. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny and hot with highs from 85 to 90. Tonight, clear and lows from 55 degrees from the White Mountains north, ranging to around 60 in central parts of the state and 65 in southern sections. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Antioch University, New England, educating practitioner scholars with their doctoral program in clinical psychology, antiochne.edu. From Tupelo Music Hall, presenting the organically handcrafted songs and stylings of Ben Taylor, Friday, July 13th in White River Junction, tickets at tupelohall.com. And from Maine Sonoda and Raritan, patent attorneys for companies that believe intellectual property is a business of the future. Maine Sonoda and Raritan, on the web at mcr-ip.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, calls for a new grand strategy for American foreign policy. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send us a short email at exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. I have two guests with me today. In studio, Bill Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and Charles Kupchan, joining us on the line from Jerusalem. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a former director of the National Security Council, and a professor of international affairs in the Walsh School at Georgetown University. And Charles, I want to come back to you with something you said right before the break. You made this comment about how the issue is who are the players who have power. And I hear a lot from people about how the nature of the threat has changed in our world with non-state actors, a different type of nuclear threat than maybe we once had. And it sounds like you're not quite convinced about that. Could you say a little bit more there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that the world has changed. International politics has changed. There are now a lot of things on the agenda that diplomats weren't thinking about 50 or 100 years ago, and they include terrorism of a sort that could be very dangerous if they get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, NGOs, non-state actors, cyber threats, pandemics. But I think that sometimes we make a mistake in assuming that those new kinds of threats have pushed off the agenda the old kinds of threats, which is simply getting great power relations right. And I think that in the end of the day, we're at a point in history where great power relations are getting more and more important, and that's because we're witnessing a shift in the distribution of power in the world. We're moving from a period of history where the United States and its Western allies have been dominant, and that's a period of almost 200 years going back to the Napoleonic Wars, to a period of history in which China, Brazil, India, Turkey, Indonesia are going to be steadily rising. And I think, if, for me, one of the big grand strategic questions of our time is, how are we going to manage that transition? How are we going to deal with a world where one part of the world has been the guardian for a long time, and that ability to be the guardian is gradually slipping away?
Bill, there is this belief out there that the nature of the threat has changed in real ways, but Charles seems to be suggesting that there is continuity with the old issue of dealing with other nation states and great powers. What's your sense of that balance between new threat and traditional threat?
I think that's a very, very a critical point, a really prescient point. What all the listeners of the show are, if they're thinking about this, what they'll see is they are watching in real time a reorientation. Charles used the word shift. I think I'd line up with that as well. A shift in global politics, as we're seeing the re-rise, the ascent again of great powers. I'm thinking particularly of Russia, and I'm thinking of China as well. And what we may be seeing, what we may have seen the last 20 years, is the absence of great power competition with the United States, hence this shift over to all the issues that all of us have been thinking about terrorism, extremism, proliferation, environmental kinds of issues and the like, because there was no great power centering or groundedness in foreign policy. That's changing as we speak. I think many are arguing now that Russia has assumed the position as probably the major power broker in the Middle East over events in Syria. That has profound consequences for grand strategy now.
So the threats may be a little bit different, but kind of the underlying power structure driving those threats is things we've already seen before.
I think that's right. And I'll tell you the question that the American people need to ask. This can be a policymaker intelligentsia kind of drill on formulating grand strategy. I don't think it is actually. I think it's a bottom up as opposed to a top down kind of process. And the question that the people listening to this show and the American people generally have to say is, what is it that we care about in world politics? What are the things that get us organized, that get us worried, issues that we have to deal with? The second issue, and we'll get to this in a moment, is what I call the domestic foundations of national power.
Yeah.
It's not just foreign policy stuff. It's maybe more domestic. And if you look at the span of American foreign policy, it may actually be as much domestic as it is global events.
And we'll talk about that. I know Charles has written as well about the role of domestic politics in the economy. Before we take our first call, I want to ask one question about institutional design. So much of what we were talking about here with grand strategy, it seems like a lot of it can be defined through political means, some sort of electoral consensus, legislative consensus. But my institutional question is, are there changes that either of you would recommend to the foreign policy bureaucracy about how the institutions function? So this is not a political question. This is an institutional design question. What would you change if you could redesign the apparatus? Charles, why don't you start?
Well, there's always improvement that can be made at the institutional level, in the sense that there's a lot of bureaucratic competition. There's a lot of time and energy wasted with one office fighting with another office. There's always some commission working on how to reform the bureaucracy. My own view would be to strengthen the decision-making power of the presidency and strengthen the National Security Council. Maybe that's because I worked there, so I'm biased, but I think that's one thing that would help. The other is to, I think, and this comes to the domestic politics question that we talked about for a second, number one, have a body in the United States that does strategic planning on the domestic economic front. Because we have that when it comes to defense. We have something called policy planning in the State Department, and they're sort of thinking about over-the-horizon issues. But right now, I'm much more worried about the domestic foundations of our foreign policy than I am about whether we have enough airplanes and tanks and whether we understand that China is rising. And so I think that the priority for me would be, what kind of institutional changes do we need at home to make the right decisions about our economy? What can we do to make our Congress function as a real legislative body, as opposed to a place where Democrats and Republicans come and throw darts at each other. That, to me, right now, is the greatest threat to our national security.
And I want to talk about political polarization and the climate domestically at length. But Jack is on the line from Portsmouth. So let's see what Jack's question is first. Jack, welcome to the exchange.
Oh, thank you. What's kind of fallen off of our national dialogue and actually debate is any link and between what happened in November of 1979 with the overthrow of or the takeover of the United States Embassy in Tehran, as it led up to the 9/11 attack on the United States. These were examples of America being with tremendous material and power, aircraft carriers and fleets, but we were powerless to defend an embassy. And at the same time, we were powerless to defend our skyscrapers and national monuments like the Pentagon and all that. So I think it's kind of a neat link in those two things with respect to foreign policy that that could be explored.
Bill, you want to take that?
Jack, excellent questions. I had a couple of thoughts. One is that democracies in our government, not to ping on democracies, but in our government, it's easy to become lax. That is that we just, things are going generally well. The world generally aligns with what we think is our interests, and we tend to tune out of other problems. And I think 9/11 is the classic example of that. Studies have been done. Many, many more will be done, which argue that we simply weren't paying attention. The second issue is that as this world there's a lag between the time something changes and the time that we recognize that change. Iran in 1979, the revolution, the radicalization that has existed since within Iranian society, something that we really were not well prepared to deal with. The other part of it, Jack, that I would add in is that what probably limited or restrained American options in the case of Iran at that time was, of course, the Cold War. And one of the big debates of the time was, and one of the reasons that President Carter established what was called the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, was to move American forces quickly to Iran to prevent the Soviet Union from pushing forces through the mountains, the Zagros Mountains, and then and take over Iran. So all this Cold War kind of stuff really limited, I think, and inhibited how the United States responded. But under classic, you know, day-to-day events become very routine, and we sometimes miss the big events. It's just unfortunately the way democracies work.
Jack, thanks for that call. I want to touch on this issue of political polarization. In reading both of your writings, Bill, you talk about the tension in Washington between a foreign policy designed to have the U.S. act in concert with other allies versus the need to keep American options open. And there's a sort of a conservative argument about American exceptionalism that we often hear in that context of that trade-off. And Charles, in your writings, you talk about a polarized climate and the idea that less is more and that the focus should be on pragmatic teamwork and flexible concerts and task-specific coalitions. I guess my question is, how do we build consensus? It's a very difficult political climate that we're facing. What are some of the ways in which we may be able to build at least an initial consensus on a unified policy? And Charles, why don't you take an initial crack at that?
You know, I'll start by, in some ways, picking up on Jack's question, because I think that one of the thrusts of his question was that Americans perhaps should be more mindful of the limits of our power, not so much in terms of what we don't have, but more in terms of what we can achieve with what we have, because I think one of the things we saw in not just the embassy crisis in Iran, but also the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and now Libya, is that the application of military force, even overwhelming military force, doesn't always achieve the outcome that we want. And in fact, I think what we see in Iraq and Afghanistan is it's a far cry from the outcome that we want. So the first point I would make is, let's be more mindful, more respectful of the limits of power to achieve specific goals, and to some extent keep our powder dry rather than going into places like Iraq and Afghanistan and thinking we can fix them. My guess is that Republicans and Democrats can actually agree on that, particularly at a time when our economy is hurting and people are responding to one of Obama's, I think, better campaign phrases, and that is, it's time for nation building at home. rather than nation building abroad. So my first point would be, you know, let's perhaps lighten the load. Let's look for agreement between Democrats and Republicans about a more judicious and a more selective brand of foreign policy. And the other place that I think one can find agreement, at least for starters, is that strength starts at home, that we are not going to get right our engagement in the world if we are running massive deficits, if we can't fix our own domestic economic industrial infrastructure. And in that sense, I think even though in the campaign season, Democrats and Republicans are heading in different directions rhetorically, I think you can build a consensus on the need for that, you know, American strength in the world is going to be jeopardized if we don't rebuild our domestic economy.
Now, Charles, I see the potential for consensus around this concept of judiciousness and restraint. But in reading a lot of your work, you use a fairly progressive language. You talk about pluralism and tolerance and an inclusive global order. I typically only hear that kind of language on one side of the aisle in Congress. So how do you reach across the aisle to Republicans who may feel like in some way you would be sacrificing the United States' potential to respond if you go to this more kind of pluralistic, inclusive strategy?
Well, you know, I think that right now Mitt Romney is kind of glomming onto a certain subset of his advisors that in many respects hail from the first administration of George W. Bush, what people tend to call the neoconservatives. It's about American power. It's about staying the course in Afghanistan. It's about doubling down on China. It's Russia is our greatest threat. And frankly, I don't think that's where the country is, and I don't think it's where the Republican Party is. I think what one sees in the Republican Party is a certain amount of exhaustion or impatience with that view. And over time, there has actually been an interesting alliance between the Tea Party and the Democrats, particularly more left-wing Democrats, about a more constrained and judicious and less costly brand of foreign policy. So when I look out at the country and I read the tea leaves, I actually think that Romney is out of step with his own party. And that's why I'm somewhat optimistic that once one gets through the campaign season, there actually is some common ground between Democrats and Republicans who are going to say, you know, it's time to focus more on the home front and rebuild our own domestic sources of strength.
And Bill, we have on the one hand an inclusive global order. On the other hand, we have American exceptionalism. It's clearly polarizing domestically and internationally. Your general sense of how to move forward in this area?
Yeah, that's interesting comments by Charles. And I think couple of points of consensus that if we're seeking to build a consensus and to move away from polarization, I think I would advance two general points. One is I find it very difficult to imagine an orderly world or a stable world without some significant degree of American leadership. On the one hand, I'm about to do the famous President Truman. I wish I had one-handed economist because economists say on the one hand, the other hand. On the other hand, I think there's a growing sense in the United States that we really have to focus on the home front. In some of the work I've done on grand strategy, I always articulated three principles. One is it's a messy, dangerous world, and it requires active American involvement and leadership. Second, we can't do everything for everybody all the time. And I think one of the weaknesses of American foreign policy in the last several decades, and I wouldn't argue this in the case of Cold War, but at least post-Cold War, is that there was too much of a tendency both on our part and the rest of the world. Something goes wrong, Americans will deal with it. We don't have to deal with it. The rest of the world doesn't have to engage. We saw that ending a bit, I think, with the earthquake in Haiti. We had a very powerful global response. And so to me, point two is we really have to start thinking in terms of rebuilding the domestic foundations of national power, which means defense spending is part of it, but it's minor. It means bridges, roads, schools, infrastructure, power grids, and on down the line. In New Hampshire, for all the people within earshot of this station, we have, I don't remember the number now, but we have a dozen or two dozen bridges that are redlined, which means they're really in serious need of repair. That says to me that there's a rebuilding here of American society. That's why a few moments ago I said the question, this can be either top-down or bottom-up. I think bottom-up from the people up in terms of what the vision is much more powerful. That's why I asked, what is it we should care about in international politics? What are the issues that should animate or organize American activity? And I think once we have a sense that there probably is some minimum and some nominal level of American leadership, and we need to start refocusing on building the foundations of American power, that's not a bad place in which to establish a consensus. And I strongly agree that consensus building probably occurs after presidential election cycles, not during them. But that's okay. That's how democracies work, frankly.
And I want to come back to this issue of domestic foundations in a moment, but Deb has been standing by on the phone in Swansea. Deb, welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thank you. I think that most Americans are just not paying enough attention, really, to a lot of the important news that's actually going on in the world. I think we suffer too much from distractions and soft news and things that really are not enabling us, like cognitive dissonance, for example, where we don't want to accept things that are uncomfortable for us to think about, and we don't look for information or accept information that is out there readily for us. I think many Americans and most Europeans, Australians, and many people in the Middle East would agree with me that the best way that the United States could try to rebuild the goodwill that we used to have throughout the world is to admit that we need to have a new investigation that really addresses the hard scientific evidence about what really happened on 9/11.
Deb, thanks for the call. We have to take a break. We'll get an answer to Deb's question as soon as we get back. we'll talk about her question. We'll talk about the domestic foundations and take more of your calls. So we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
That much easier if you're the early bird winner of NHPR's Summer Car Raffle. The prize, as usual, is $2,000 in gas gift cards courtesy of Irving Oil. Make sure you get your $50 tickets by August 4th at nhpr.org. But otherwise, kick back and enjoy the summertime.
And think of the summers of the past. Adjust the bass and let the alpine.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million-dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings. On time, on budget, online at northbranch.net. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll discuss a worldwide rise in trade protectionism. Email us your thoughts to exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning at 9. Today, what should America's foreign policy look like? Join us with your questions and comments by calling in at 1-800-892-6477 or emailing us at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also check out our Facebook page. Two guests with me today in studio, Bill Martell. He is an international relations professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And joining us on the line from Jerusalem is Charles Kupchin, who is an international affairs professor at the Walsh School at Georgetown University. And Charles, let's go back to Deb's comments right before the break. Americans not enabled. She talked a bit about goodwill around the world. You're traveling now abroad. What's your sense of goodwill?
Well, I would agree with what Deb said, that Americans often don't know as much as they should about the world. And I think that's partly because we live in a very big country. And when you're somewhere in the middle of the country or even somewhere on the coast, the outside world doesn't seem to impinge on you. When you live in Israel, a place that's about 8 miles wide, 9 miles wide at its narrowest, or even in Europe, where if you drive for 7 hours, you probably go through four countries, people are just forced to be more engaged and knowledgeable about what's happening beyond their borders. But I do think that there has been a recovery in the opinion of the United States during the Obama years, in the sense that he became more multilateralist. He attempted to restore the vision, the image of the United States abroad. But there's also no question that our polarization at home is costly abroad. I would just offer one example, and that would be climate change, where many people around the world, particularly in Europe, were hoping that the U.S. would go for some sort of cap and trade or carbon tax. Obama wanted to head in that direction, but he realized that it was basically a non-starter in Congress. And there, in that sense, our domestic politics, to some extent, make it harder for us to reestablish some of the credibility abroad that many diplomats might like.
Bill, you jump in?
A couple of quick thoughts. One, I think the American people, I concur with Charles that, you know, that we don't pay arguably as much attention as maybe the foreign policy community would like. But I think the American people are very Darwinian, very practical. And I think they focus on foreign policy when it's important to do so. And they do so typically when we confront a problem. The second issue that with Deb, I would agree. I think that at a time of high unemployment, very low growth, a global economy which is struggling, and the American economy, as I first points, are struggling, I think it's natural that we focus inward. And I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. I think if the world generates difficulties, we're pretty good at responding to those kinds of things. But I think there's a very practical focus in American politics now on the nature of the domestic difficulties that we face. And I think unless there's a terrible event globally, it's natural and, in fact, the right thing, frankly, for democracies to focus inward.
Let's go back to the phones. Kevin is calling from Auburn. Kevin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. You were talking about focusing inward, and I just wanted to get your guest comments on the thought and the issue that we have this vast military base system all around the world and how that impacts our foreign policy, the pressure to act, to intervene in all these places. For example, with Libya, we had jets very close in Italy, made it very easy in a way to intervene, a lot of pressure on the president to intervene. And you see, seems to see that all place after place where we have the military in place. And the question is, and if we're going to be focusing inward, maybe there should be more focus on shrinking some of this military complex outside the U.S., both for economic reasons and also so we don't have as much pressure to act in the outside world. I'm just interested in their thoughts.
Thanks, Kevin. Charles, what's your sense of our U.S. military presence around the world? Do we need to scale back? Is it just about right?
Well, I'd go back to something that Bill said about 10 minutes ago, and that is that we still live in a world where we need American leadership, and that's because there isn't another responsible stakeholder out there with the full portfolio of assets that we have when it comes to projecting power, when it comes to providing aid, when it comes to dealing with humanitarian crises. So I'm not someone who believes that we should pack it in, become isolationist, and close our bases. At the same time, I think that we probably have overreached. We've got something in the range of 700 overseas bases. The United States spends more on defense than all other major powers combined. And I think especially at a time in history when we need to rebuild our domestic economic base, we can afford a selective retrenchment. And in that respect, I think that a cut to the defense budget is not only feasible because we may not need to spend as much as we've been spending, but also necessary because it's part of getting our house in order. And so the conversation that I would like to see Americans have, the conversation I would like to see Romney and Obama have when they debate each other is, how much is enough? How can we, in a responsible, measured, judicious way, adjust to a world where we need to do somewhat less and at the same time make room for the Chinas, Brazils, and Indians of the world, all of whom would like to have a bigger seat at the table.
Bill, I know you've written on this issue as well.
Couple of thoughts. One, Kevin, that has been a classic debate. And I think, frankly, the national security foreign policy community is very open to those kinds of discussions. Second, in terms of U.S. defense spending, we spend the most, and there's a classic chart that people generate, and they say if you take the American defense budget and then take all the next budgets from the second to the nth largest, you go like 25 or 30 countries down the line before you have countries that are spending equivalent to what we do. So one observation is, gee, we're spending too much. I might make a counter-argument or a counter-proposal is that one of the reasons we're spending a lot is others aren't spending perhaps what they should. And I'll give you an example. We spend 3.5-4% of defense gross domestic product on defense. European states are spending between 1-2%. In the events in Libya in the last year, when we were when NATO countries, particularly the Italians and the British and the French, were conducting airstrikes against Libya, they couldn't run an air campaign against Libya without significant American support. That says to me maybe they're spending not enough. And it goes back to a point I made a while ago, and I said that we can't do everything for everybody. Others need to do more. I'm a firm believer that we can spread responsibility much more equitably on a global scale. And, Kevin, I think that's the issue that people are debating in terms of defense spending. And probably defense spending will go down, I suspect, with Afghanistan and Iraq probably winding down as we're watching.
Charles, I want to jump back to the domestic foundations argument, and I thought it was fascinating in your article about the four pillars of a grand strategy. You talk about the importance of dealing with income inequality domestically, and typically when people think about foreign policy, they don't necessarily think about issues like income inequality in the United States. Can you make that connection for our listeners a little bit, how that drives a foreign policy strategy?
We started off, I think, the conversation talking about consensus and the importance, in, especially in democratic societies, of building legislative support for foreign policy. And the United States has historically been a country that's deeply divided over its engagement in the world, going back really to 1789 when we really began life, and Democrats, well, they weren't called Democrats at the time, but the Federalist Party and the Republican Party were deeply split over whether to tilt to France or tilt to Britain. They were deeply split about whether to be free trading or protectionist. And the country was very divided through most of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century. And then you hit the post-World War II era, and you begin to see the sweet spot in American politics emerge as the center. Republicans and Democrats, moderates on both sides of the aisle, came together and really provided a domestic foundation for American engagement in the world. And that ran right through most of the Clinton era. And the reason that I think the inequality issue was so important is that that center in American politics emerged in part because of the diminishing inequality of the post-war era, the fact that Americans of both working class, middle class, and upper class were benefiting from the post-war boom. And it was really that sense that people's boats were all floating up that allowed Roosevelt to come together and cobble together a centrist, bipartisan consensus that was the foundation for American foreign policy. I think one of the reasons that our country is now so deeply divided is that our middle classes are hurting. They have seen their houses disappear, their jobs disappear, their incomes have been stagnant for the better part of two decades, and that is now resonating right through our political discourse and our political debate. And that's why I think getting our middle classes back on their feet, seeing their homes get out of foreclosure, is in many respects central to re-anchoring our engagement abroad.
So domestic economic well-being can have international repercussions for us. Let's go back to the phones. We have Zach on the line in Bedford. Zach, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much. I'm a first-time caller. I love the show.
Welcome.
I believe the man from Israel said, and I do agree with him, that right now there is no other country that's willing to take the place of America being the foreign or being the power that the world needs right now. But I do have a question. I think this is what many foreign countries disagree with and probably get mad at us about, is we're very selective in what we choose. And so I'm wondering, do we need to be selective like we are now? Like, we went to Libya, but not Syria, where the same thing basically happened. And in my opinion, I think we just went to Libya because of the oil. But we decided not to do anything militaristically wise in Syria, where it might be even worse. So do we need to be selective like we are now? Or do we need to be full force like we were in World War II, World War I, and just have all engines go and have everyone behind the situation?
Now, Bill, we heard Charles talk earlier in the show about this issue of being selective and judicious and showing restraint. What's your sense of how selective we need to be?
I think the two extremes that we can eliminate is no American involvement, American isolationism on the one hand. The other side is America involved everywhere all the time. And we can eliminate those two possibilities. And that's easy. And the devil's in the details. It puts us in the middle. It seems to me we need to be more selective. And I think we're going to see this in American foreign policy, I think particularly after a decade of involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think a source of polarization here in the States is in part economic, as Charles just outlined, and in part it's an absence of what it is that we're supposed to do in foreign policy. If we think about the great defining American grand strategies, I think of in the Second World War, and I think that and after the Second World, during the Cold War, those were externally driven. Those were threats that confronted us. A challenge for the United States is to understand when something is really serious and requires a significant involvement that should force us to rethink our grand strategy. The other point I'd make, too, is that in a way, what we did in foreign policy in our grand strategy was based on the foundation we established between the 1930s during the beginnings of the beginnings of rebuilding during the Depression and right up through the late 70s, 1980s. That was when we built and established the foundations of American power, in part because there was a clear consensus on American foreign policy. Famous expression that people talk about, which is foreign policy debate should end at the water's edge. We should have a certain bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. And I think in the absence of a consensus on what we should be doing with the economic difficulties we face, I think what we're looking at is what we see today, which is this great sense of confusion and disorder both here and overseas.
And Charles, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to ask you kind of go back to the big picture. How close are we, do you think, to achieving a new grand strategy? And what are the most important first steps that you think we should take to achieve that goal?
Well, I think there are two grand strategic questions on the table now. One of them is when, how quickly is the global distribution of power shifting? When are we going to be in a multipolar world? That is to say, in a world in which the United States is no longer the provider, the guardian, the lender of last resort. And my answer to that is very soon. I think we've probably got another decade and a half in what one could call Pax Americana, but we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And so the first thing that I ask is, how are we going to get from here to there peacefully? And the second grand strategic question I would ask is, what will it mean when we get there? What will be the rules of the road? Who will be calling the shots? And I think there's a dominant view, at least in Washington, that the Western order, the world that we have built, the institutions we have built, are stable even as the balance of power shifts. I don't believe that. I think that the Chinese and the Turks and the Brazilians and others are going to be bringing to the table their own conceptions of order, their own views about legitimacy, about sovereignty, about commerce. So the second question I would ask is, what are going to be the norms? What are going to be the new rules? How can we arrive at them? How can we forge a new consensus? Unfortunately, particularly because we're in an election season where everybody thinks they need to say that the 21st century is an American century, we're not going to be asking either of those questions. But I think they're urgent, and I hope that whoever wins in November will start to engage in national discourse on those fundamental issues of where the world is headed.
Bill, we've got about a minute left, minute and a half. Your sense of how close we are to a unified strategy, and what are the next steps?
I don't think we're close, unless there's a great external event that will force us to redefine American grand strategy. I tend to think we're going to continue in the steady state. I think the solution to the question of what should organize our thinking in foreign policy is based on really three principles. And one is the world remains dangerous and poses challenges to us, and we can't operate without American leadership. The second is that we have to rebuild the domestic foundations of power, as Charles and I and so many have mentioned. And the third is that others around the world have to become more engaged. And in the absence of that engagement, it will push the United States, and will resist on occasion, push us into more involvement. And I think it's the absence of a consensus on those points that feeds this sense of polarization in American society, plus we have this great economic difficulty that we're confronting here in American society.
Well, you've both given us a really intriguing framework for a future discussion, but as you can hear, we're out of time. I want to thank both of my guests for joining us this morning. Charles, thanks so much for being with us, especially joining us all the way from Jerusalem.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That's Charles Kupchan. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and former director of the National Security Council. He's also a professor of international affairs in the Walsh School at Georgetown University. His new book is No One's World, The West, The Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. And Bill Martell, Bill, it's always good to see you.
It's always my pleasure, Dean. Thank you.
That's Bill Martell, associate professor of international relations, security studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. He's author of Victory in War, Foundations of Modern Strategy. Both of our guests have written articles on this topic. To read them, go to the Exchange page at nhpr.org, or you can find them on our Facebook page. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Claudia Camarino and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the protectionism predicament. Tariffs, quotas, import-limiting regulations are all on the rise, with countries increasingly trying to boost their own economies. Meanwhile, lawmakers in the U.S. are pondering new Buy American provisions as the EU considers its own Buy European initiative. But many say these tactics can have unwanted effects, including foreign retaliation and job loss. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.